Now, my original intention was to make a podcast on the best films of 2020, following on from my best of 2019. But as everyone knows, new movies were thin on the ground last year, and what did get released, I mostly didn't watch. So I decided to switch to my favourite decade in cinema, the 1990s, and I finally got around to producing this podcast several months after first coming up with the idea. The list you're about to hear is a very personal one, and I've managed to get it down to a top 22. I wasn't disciplined enough to get it down to 20. But to balance things out, I'm also turning to collaborators for their favourites. So we'll be hearing from Chris Deasy from the Nostalgia podcast, and also from Amanda Reyes from the Made for TV Mayhem podcast, and they'll be joining me later to give us their favourites from the decade. If you've got an issue with my choices, I should say that I saw more films during this decade than I did any other, and it's my podcast, so I can do what I like. But as I glance down the list in front of me, I also have to admit that it might raise a few eyebrows. These films are those that I consider to be the best based on my own criteria for a good movie. Many of the established so-called classics of this decade are missing, but not for any contrarian reasons, but simply because they're not my favourites, or they're good movies but they don't quite meet my top 22, or because they don't meet my criteria for a good film. In many cases, I find these so-called classics to be insufferably mawkish, boring, or made so conspicuously to establish notions of quality, in inverted commas, that I've just got this natural revulsion for them. I won't mention any specific films that are missing, but you'll know what I mean when you listen through. Don't be expecting to hear the Shawshank Redemption crop up here, let's put it that way. But hopefully, if nothing else, you'll agree with at least a few of my suggestions, or it might prompt you to revisit some of my choices. Now, I know what you're thinking here. Will Nuns on the Run make the final 22? Well, I can't reveal that at this point, so keep listening. Now, as I've said, the 90s was the greatest decade in cinema ever, so there are a lot of really brilliant films that just miss out. So I want to run down some honourable mentions before I get down to my top 22. Time for a deep breath. Crybaby, Shortcuts, Gremlins 2, The Long Kiss Goodnight, Deconstructing Harry, Young Guns 2, The Last Boy Scout, Candyman, The Crying Game, Carlito's Way, Falling Down, Hard Target, Fresh, Any Given Sunday, Galaxy Quest, Lady Bird, Go. Wes Craven's New Nightmare, Clueless, The Usual Suspects, Tokyo Fist, Beavis and Butthead Do America, The Great White Hype, Kingpin, The Rock, Starship Troopers, Office Space, Air America, Boiling Point, Goodfellas, Total Recall, Jurassic Park, Freeway and Freeway 2, Wild at Heart, New Jack City, Hard Boiled, Man Bites Dog, Bad Boy Bubby, The Getaway, Killing Zoe, Menace to Society, Die Hard with a Vengeance, ID, Breaking the Waves, The Cable Guy, Buffalo 66, Kurt and Courtney, and Bowfinger. Those are the honourable mentions out of the way. Here's my final top 22 movies of the 1990s. Away we go. Number 22 is When We Were Kings, the documentary based on the George Foreman versus Muhammad Ali Rumble in the Jungle fight from 1974. This is a highly influential film. If you watch any sporting documentary now, they nearly all have archive material with popular music and political footage of protests and activism. When We Were Kings was one of the first to bring these features together, linking sport with popular culture and politics, and racial politics in particular when it comes to boxing. It's a wonderful piece of history. The boxing match itself is one of the most justly famous of all time for all sorts of reasons. And When We Were Kings tells this story in a really inspiring and fascinating way. It's a terrific true story, wonderfully told. At number 21 is Just Another Girl on the IRT, directed by Leslie Harris and starring Arian Johnson. Now, lots of 90s movies have a handheld in the streets style aesthetic, and this one's one of the most inspiring for me. Very low budget movie, and like a lot of films on this list, it's a debut feature. I love the subway look. It's shot on New York subways. I like the way it's shot in tableaus that get punctuated by Johnson breaking the fourth wall and talking to the camera in a very confident manner. The shooting style looks effortless, and some great use of New York locations. It also has a fantastic soundtrack, and it's just a great piece of working class cinema. Difficult to get hold of, but it is available on Amazon Prime Video now. I suggest you go and check this film out. Just Another Girl on the IRT. Number 20 on the list, squeezing into the top 20, is Shakespeare in Love. Perhaps as far removed from a lot of the other films on this list as it's possible to be. But it's hard to think of a film as purely enjoyable and as well crafted as this. Joseph Fiennes is always a good performer, and this is real leading man stuff from him. He's very dashing, he's handsome, but he's also vulnerable, like all excellent leading men. Gwyneth Paltrow is one of my favourite actors too. This is one of her breakout roles, but nobody's bad in this movie. It's one of the best romantic comedies of all time, and it's got a fantastic ending too. At number 19, we've got The Krays. Now, this was the first film about the Kray twins, followed more recently by Legend and two or three very low-budget straight-to-home DVD versions. But this one's the best for me. Now, what it gets right, more than the other films about this story do, is that they focus on the mythology of the Kray twin story rather than realism. Now, the film opens with an allegorical story very much like the Castor and Pollux myth. And this is not only very important to get the overall weirdness of the Kray twin story across, but also makes for a very strange, off-key, off-kilter crime film that deviates away from the focus on criminal practice, which typifies the genre. There's some very gruesome violence in this movie. It looks fantastic. The Kemp twins playing Ronnie and Reggie Kray are superb. Their debuts as actors, and they make great central performances. At number 18, Con Air. Out of all the bombastic action films of the 1990s, this is perhaps my favourite. Like many of the films on this list, it's an ensemble piece with a superb cast acting out very quotable dialogue. As in a lot of Bruckheimer-produced films, the action isn't necessarily great. They tend to go for scale and explosions rather than tight editing and impactful violence. But the interplay between the characters is superb. And they're really colourful characters too. Cyrus the Virus, Johnny 23, Billy Bedlam, the Marietta Mangler and more. At 18, Con Air. So now's a good time to hand over to Chris Deasy from the Nostalgia Podcast to tell us his favourite film of the 1990s.
Hi James, thank you so much for inviting me to choose my favourite film of the 90s. And to be honest with you, I think I could have drawn up a list of 100 films, which at different times over the years have all been my best film of the 90s and maybe even the best film ever. But I think The Fugitive is the film I'm going to pick. And I'm actually going to pick it because there was a sequel to the film a few years later, which was everything that The Fugitive wasn't. And it kind of reinforced my sense that The Fugitive is so good because, on the one hand, it's kind of a bit generic. It has lots of things in it that you wouldn't necessarily would expect to be Oscar worthy. I mean, it was nominated for Best Picture, and indeed Tommy Lee Jones won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor back in, well, it would have been, what, the ceremony in March or April, whenever it was, 1994. And I think it's seeing how other films of the genre are done that just shows what The Fugitive has that puts it into a very different sort of category. And it's a film that has really stayed with me over the years. I can watch it multiple times and never sort of get bored. Although I kind of know where it's going, there are new angles, new ingredients to pick up on all the time. And I remember the review in Empire magazine when US Marshals, which I didn't see when it came out, and I've only seen in more recent years. And I remember Empire magazine said in, what, 1998, that where The Fugitive was smart, innovative and taut, this is generic, uninspired and devoid of suspense. Now, let me just go through The Fugitive and tell you why I think it's quite a remarkable film. And I think it's the Hitchcockian innocent man on the run premise which lifts it above what could have been a perfectly pedestrian enterprise. You've got Harrison Ford constantly running away from. He's outmaneuvering the law enforcement official dispatched to find him, bring him back into custody after he's accused of murdering his wife. And I think it turns into something almost existential, Kafkaesque even, as the challenges are far from run-of-the-mill, but get to the heart of Ford's character as a top Chicago surgeon. He's falsely accused of murdering his wife, who's not merely resourceful in terms of escaping from Tommy Lee Jones's US Marshal, but acts in such an unexpected way. I mean, we see him saving the life of a prison officer in that nail-biting scene towards the beginning of the film. I don't even think the credits are finished rolling at this point, when he's on the prison bus, which the other inmates are taking over, and there's a train hurtling towards the bus, and some of the prisoners escapes. But he manages to save the life of the prison officer. And then there's a boy in a hospital whose life-threatening condition has not been diagnosed, and Ford is pretending to be a janitor so he can break into the computers in the hospital and get information about this elusive one-armed man who he believes did kill his wife, and he has to prove this, to establish this, so that his innocence can be proven. And I think what's really interesting is that Tommy Lee Jones is thrown by all of this, because if Ford, or, you know, Dr. Richard Kimball, the character he's playing, were really guilty, why would he use his medical expertise to save the lives of others when in doing so he is drawing attention to himself and to his whereabouts? And I think what works in The Fugitive is that the tension never lets up. And this film has the effect of playing in real time. The most curious dimension is the way in which Tommy Lee Jones undergoes a character trajectory. At the beginning, he really doesn't care whether Ford is guilty or not. His goal, after all, is the straightforward one of pursuing his quarry. Then later on, he begins to respect how Ford will go to so much effort to leave clues for him that point towards his innocence. And Harrison Ford plays Richard Kimball as a man of, you know, unqualified decency who cannot not act as he does. So all of his actions are very much in character. He's not just playing by the rules of the game. And I think Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones have more in common than sets them apart. And I remember watching Barry Norman. It's interesting how the film review sticks in my mind from back in September 1993, when in his review, I mean, Norman was generally positive about the film, but he thought that the film might have taken more risks and maybe reversed the roles that Ford and Jones play. Yet they represent two different sides of the same coin. And the cat and mouse game that is played is never less than cerebral. So why have I chosen The Fugitive? Well, I don't just think that it deserved its Best Picture Oscar nomination. I think it's one of the best pictures of the decade.
Thank you, Chris. That was great. Back to my list. At number 17, Husbands and Wives by Woody Allen. One of Woody Allen's best films. Comes from his angrier period. You can put Deconstructing Harry in that bracket too. Lots of energy, uses a handheld camera. In the Faber book, Woody on Woody, he talks about how he made this film and he just wanted to go for energy and performances. And if actors wandered into a part of the set or the location that was underlit or dark, as long as the performance was good, he let it go. It was very much about getting that sense of drive and movement through the use of the camera. Husbands and Wives at 17. At 16, I'm going for Glengarry Glen Ross, based on a David Mamet play. This really dark drama about salesmen. Again, fantastic dialogue, as you would expect from David Mamet. And the acting is obviously incredible from a high-profile cast. Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Alec Baldwin, Jonathan Pryce, Kevin Spacey, Ed Harris, and several others. Now, I really like this film a lot. I was working in sales when I first saw this film, and its themes were very familiar from what I could see around me. The Alec Baldwin scene in this movie was actually added to the film. It's not part of the play originally, although I do believe now they've incorporated it when this play is performed live. And it's a really electric piece of cinema based purely on good dialogue and good acting, and not through action or violence or anything like that. Glengarry Glen Ross at number 16. At number 15, I've gone for Darren Aronofsky's Pi. His debut movie, shot in black and white, made for about $40,000 or $50,000, set in Chinatown in New York, about a maths genius trying to find patterns on the stock market and who is pursued for his talents by Orthodox Jews who want him to translate the Torah, and a Wall Street firm who want him to predict the financial markets exclusively for them. Clint Mansell from the black country band Pop Will Eat Itself wrote the score, and that started a long collaboration between him and Aronofsky that lasted several films. This is a really exciting movie, a low-key, lo-fi science fiction film very small scale in terms of the way it's made, but feels big because of its themes. Another fantastic debut film that makes my top 22. At number 14, we've got The Blair Witch Project. What is there to say about this movie? Very famous, an absolute sensation when it was first released. A found footage horror forebear, really. Of course, there were found footage horror movies before this. We've got Cannibal Holocaust being one of them, and also a long ancestry of found footage. If you're interested in this, you can check out the Alexandra Heller Nicholas book on found footage horror movies, which goes through this lineage of found footage in extreme detail. But The Blair Witch Project is probably the best of the lot of those. It still works. It's got some superb scenes. Again, extremely low budget. Wonderful atmosphere. And there's a wonderful use of form in this film that many of the found footage movies struggle with. And if you look at the sequel to Blair Witch, not Blair Witch 2, but Blair Witch that was released a few years ago, where they're using drones and high definition, it really doesn't work for me. It needs this 16mm, 8mm, mini DV aesthetic to make it work. And the Blair Witch is just a wonderful 90s movie in that regard. At number 13, I'm picking Seven. Another very, very famous film, like Blair Witch. Everyone knows what happens. Everyone knows what it's about. Everyone's got an opinion on this. Seven is a real rush of a film for me. It's a proper thriller, an adult thriller that's genuinely disturbing. And the title sequence that uses a version of Nine Inch Nails is Closer is one of the greatest of all time and really provides a fantastic, exciting start. The way it's shot, it looks like New York. Apparently it was shot in Los Angeles. It's raining all the time, apart from during the famous final scenes. And a film that was a real well-deserved phenomenon at the time. At number 12, I've gone for The Full Monty. Fantastic British film. Again, another sensation. Did brilliantly in domestically, did brilliantly in America. And this film is often discussed in terms of gender. But it stands out for me because it's a great piece of working class cinema. It's always funny. It's a genuine feel-good film. And if ever this crops up on television and you watch the first few moments, you end up watching all of it. The Full Monty at number 12. And number 11, True Romance. Now, this is Tony Scott's best film, directed from a Tarantino script that was originally non-linear and told out of sequence. And Scott made the decision to make it linear, and that results in it being a very fast head rush of a movie. It's very violent, it's very disturbing, but also very funny. Now, I've always found this movie an uncomfortable watch because it's got a real edge to it. But that's what makes it such exciting filmmaking. I think this was Tarantino's first script. It would have been interesting to see what he would have done with it. I think Scott's decision to make it linear is the correct one. Christian Slater, Patricia Arquette, and a whole host of other actors fill out this ensemble cast. We're noticing these patterns when you put these movies together. And it's a film that often gets forgotten when we're thinking of Tony Scott because it's far more smaller scale than what he's used to, but it's a real testament to what a great filmmaker he was. At number 10, we've got Fire Walk With Me. This is David Lynch's Twin Peaks spin-off and prequel, and it took me a while to appreciate this film. I saw it when it first came out. I was a big fan of Twin Peaks at the time. I thought, you know, it's okay. But I really didn't start appreciating it until many years later. This is my favourite David Lynch film. It's a pure horror film. It's terrifying, but it's also hilarious and it's sad and a real tribute to everyone who was involved in producing this, the world of Twin Peaks. Okay, we're in my top 10 now. So let's move over and ask Amanda Reyes about her favourite film of the decade.
Hi, my name is Amanda Reyes, and I was really happy that James invited me to talk about my favorite films of the 90s. I'll be honest, it was an extremely difficult choice for me. I have a lot of favorite films from the 90s. That was a big decade of discovery. By the early 90s, you know, I was out of school and working in a video store, and I can remember renting like six movies a night at midnight when I got off work and watching four of them before I went to bed that night, or I guess it would be in the morning, really. I have great memories of watching movies with my friend like at 7 a.m. after we stayed up all night. So, you know, the direct-to-video market was booming, art houses were in, and I was in love with discovery. It was the decade I discovered Merchant and Ivory, period piece dramas, and it was the decade I started watching grisly horror movies. It was also the decade I started going to the movies by myself, and I was consuming everything. I have a lot of favorites. Jackie Brown, Reservoir Dogs, those are the first two that came to mind, as well as Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. And I think any of those three could have easily have been a favorite, with Jackie Brown maybe topping my list, honestly. But there's a movie that really grew on me in the later part of the 90s, and so while it's not my absolute favorite, it's a film I return to often because it holds really strong personal meaning for me. So by the time The Craft came out in 1996, I was a little too old to be the target audience, but, you know, honestly, I was also watching movies like Castle Freak and Dead Alive, really, so I wasn't really watching the more mainstream theatrical fare at the time. And if I was going to the theater, I was into the darker stuff like Jacob's Ladder and Candyman. So when it came out, The Craft didn't actually really appeal to me, and I ended up missing its original theatrical run, which I regret. I did end up renting it, of course, and I liked it. I liked it a lot, but I didn't think much about it until about a year or so after that viewing. So by then, I had moved from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, and The Craft had become a basic cable standard. It seemed to be on every night of the week when I got home from work. And basically, even though I was starving and in a really bad apartment and in a really bad place financially and actually in a really bad relationship at the time, I somehow managed to pay my cable bill. So I would come home from work, take off my shoes, and I would tend to catch The Craft on one of the cable channels. It was usually already partway into the movie when I would see it. The Craft would end up becoming very important to me for a lot of reasons. But I guess what strikes me most about it when I look back is that I think it was the first film where I consciously found myself relating to the characters. Like, I'm sure I was always doing that to some degree, but it was with The Craft that I was thinking as much about how I related to the four lead women as I was thinking about them as characters with their own stories. And I think because of that, it is really a film that many young women can relate to. But in the end, it was Neve Campbell who I was really drawn to. I was quite a bit like her in school, even more so than Ally Sheedy in The Breakfast Club. That was a character that everybody told me I reminded them of. But I think I was more like Neve. When I first started to watch the movie on a regular basis, some of the scenes with Campbell were actually kind of painful to watch. Because, you know, that introverted freak thing? It's very real, and it brought back a lot of the darker memories of my high school years. But I think there's a catharsis there, too. You know, that kind of feeling like you're not alone. And what I find so fascinating about her character, if you remember, she's scarred all over her body, but I think that's sort of a metaphor for the pain she feels inside, and I was really drawn to that. And I think that's going to bring me to another aspect of The Craft that I love. Its exploration into female friendship is really amazing. That's always been an important component of horror films for me, probably because of my love of slashers, which tend to feature an array of dynamic female characters spending a lot of time together. So therefore, my favorite scenes in The Craft are at the beginning when Robin Tunney's character first joins the other three, and they slowly evolve into four women who rely on each other to get through the horrors of high school. That was something I used to pray for when I was in school, but never really got. So the magic stuff in the film, for me, is kind of an afterthought, because I just really liked hanging out with these characters. It was more rare in the 90s, and prior to that, of course, you didn't see a lot of women making these types of films. You know, there's a handful of them, of course, but mostly we had to rely on men to make the stories work. And I think that Andrew Fleming, who's the director, and screenwriter Peter Filardi did a really good job of capturing teen angst. They captured the loneliness of difference and the importance of female bonds. And they did it all in this wonderful sort of mainstream popcorn crowd pleaser, which is amazing. Also, The Craft sort of reeks of L.A. I'm actually not sure where they shot the movie, but Tunney's house looked like all the homes I'd see on my way to work. I lived in a pretty poor part of Los Angeles, but it was adjacent to West Hollywood and Beverly Hills. And for a time, I actually lived at the foot of the Hollywood Hills in a pretty crappy apartment, but I saw all the beauty around me. And there was something really familiar about a lot of the location work. And looking into Tunney's home in a way was like peeping into my neighbor's house and seeing how beautiful I just knew it was going to be. And so there's kind of a fantasy element in The Craft for me too. It has nothing to do with the magic, but it really beguiled me, this sort of idea of like the seedy and the glamorous side of Los Angeles, which I think are depicted both very well in the film. You know, it's just a good movie with a great soundtrack. It has four amazing actresses. It's the kind of film that understood its audience, didn't pander to them, but it also didn't set out to reinvent the wheel. It's a comfort blanket with snakes, right? That's what it is. I finally got to see The Craft on the big screen last October at a drive-in here in Austin. You know what? It's lost none of its charm. It's a little bittersweet in a way, since one of the actors who plays Skeet Ulrich's friend, he passed away a few years ago. I was a big fan of him. He was just an actor I loved. He did soaps. That's kind of where I know him from. And of course, everyone else in the movie has gone on to different degrees of success and taken different paths. And I don't know how often any of them think back on the film, but you know, I'll always remember them like this, as sort of strange friends who got me through a rough time in my life. And did I mention how amazing that soundtrack is?
Thanks very much, Amanda, for your contribution. Really appreciate that. The Craft was one of those films that I saw at the time, didn't think much of it, and I caught it again recently on an all-night screening at the Prince Charles Cinema, and I enjoyed it a lot more that second time. So thanks for reminding us of that. So, my number 9 is Naked. Now, like Woody Allen, Mike Leigh is not necessarily known for making angry movies, but this one feels very aggressive and nihilistic. It stars David Thewlis as a Mancunian drifter in London, and it's got some savage scenes, particularly ones involving sexual violence. Lee's use of tracking shots in this film, remember he's not known for using things like tracking shots and that form of technique, is masterful, and he uses them judiciously to create meaning and effect rather than as a ubiquitous technique just to create a sense of movement, which so many modern films and TV shows overuse, in my opinion. At number 8, I'm going for Scream. Now, even though this is a parody and pastiche of the slasher movie, it's probably my favourite example of the cycle. I first saw this on Saturday night in a packed cinema, and I had no idea what it was about other than it was a new Wes Craven horror film. And it was just a great experience with people screaming at the jumpy moments and everyone getting involved. It was one of my favourite ever nights at the pictures. It's got a great script by Kevin Williamson. Scream 2, the sequel, wasn't bad, pretty good. And Scream 4 definitely had its moments, but they don't come close to this. And I really like the version of Whisper to a Scream by Soho on the end credits too. Scream's really terrific, fun stuff. At 7, I'm going for Unforgiven, which I believe was Clint Eastwood's final Western. Now, famously, he held onto the script for a number of years, I think over 10 years, until he was ready and old enough to portray the lead character of William Money. And this is a deconstruction of the Western. It's very much about aging gunfighters and what happens to them and how myths are created around their exploits, which are often written up and depicted as ones of heroism and glamour, but in reality is often very sordid. And the violence in this film is very sordid, it's very undignified, and it's amateurish, and it's messy. At the same time, Eastwood manages to do that deconstruction whilst also mythologizing the West. And the final shootout in the bar, even though it's messy and it's close and it's not stylized, still has a sense of grandeur about it. And Unforgiven, it's one of the great Westerns. At number 6, I'm going for Reservoir Dogs. Now, whatever you think about Reservoir Dogs, whatever you think about Quentin Tarantino, this is the film that really boosted the 1990s indie filmmaking revival. Linklater had made some indie films before. Gus Van Sant had been making some indie movies prior to this, but it was Reservoir Dogs that really made this mainstream. It's a really important film in that regard. It's obviously Tarantino's leanest movie. It may well be his shortest. It's a far harder movie than Pulp Fiction, which was more celebrated. And again, I was quite young in this country. Reservoir Dogs was denied a home video release for many, many years. And so it just kept coming back onto the cinema. Every now and every couple of months, different cinemas would be showing Reservoir Dogs. And I think I managed to rack up about 10 viewings of this in the cinema over a couple of years. Interestingly, even though it is a lean movie, hour and 45 minutes, there's a lot more material that Tarantino doesn't use that's on the deleted scenes. There's a lot more material that could have fleshed this out into a more standard Tarantino 2 hours, 2.5 hour length. But the cutting that's employed here to make this a stripped down experience really suits it. And again, one of the several debut movies on my top 22 list. At number 5, I've gone for Kevin Smith's debut low budget comedy, Clerks, which was famously funded through credit cards and selling his own comic book collection. Clerks is set in one location, like so many famous debut movies, to cut down on budget and to cut down on the logistical and financial problems of having multiple locations. It's a hilarious comedy by a mostly amateur cast, some of whom went on to acting careers after this, even if that was mostly in other Kevin Smith productions. Now, out of the low-budget, slacker-style hangout films of the 1990s, this one's probably the most authentic and probably the best. And Kevin Smith has kept on returning to this story over and over again. It's part of a wider universe involving some of his other films like Chasing Amy and Mallrats. And there was also a sequel to Clerks that came out many years later. At number four, I've gone for Sonatine, a meditative Japanese gangster film from Takeshi Kitano. It's got some really striking, unusually constructed shootouts, particularly one near the end that's illuminated through machine gun fire. The lights in the room have been tripped, so there's no lights on. And Kitano, who's also playing the lead role, is using a machine gun to mow down his enemies, and the muzzle flash illuminates the action. Kitano also has a background as a comedian, and this is reflected in the film's bizarre sense of humour. And Sonatine is not really interested in being a pulse-pounding thriller. It's got far more of a lyrical, slow pace, and a film that doesn't get mentioned very often, but it's a really wonderful experience if you get around to seeing this. So Sonatine at number four. At number three, I've gone for Bad Lieutenant. Even though he'd made many films prior to this, Bad Lieutenant is the quintessential Abel Ferrara movie, containing many of his typical themes, setting and cast. And it's one of the great New York films. Like other Abel Ferrara films, we focus on drug use, sexual violence, and it's got a really grimy, earthy aesthetic. But it's also very funny. Maybe that's just me, but I find this film hilarious in many parts. It's about a corrupt policeman with a drug habit and gambling debts who attempts to seek redemption by solving the crime of the rape of a nun. And it's the most fully realised of Ferrara's New York Underground films, revisiting particular themes such as Catholicism and street life that he explored previously in King of New York and Driller Killer, as well as Miss 45. Now, it goes without saying that Harvey Keitel is amazing in the lead role. He was at the top of his game in the 1990s, as we know from films like The Piano and Reservoir Dogs. But we also want to note the contribution here to Bad Lieutenant of Zoe Lund, who co-wrote the movie and had also appeared in Miss 45 in the lead role, who's sadly now deceased. So Bad Lieutenant at number three. At number two, I've gone for Martin Scorsese's Casino. A really underrated Scorsese film, this. I truly believe it's a stronger movie than Goodfellas, with which it shares a similar cast and themes and the gangster storyline. What makes Casino stand out for me is Scorsese's use of technique. And here it's at its absolute apex. The camera is constantly moving. It's seeking to transport you through the world of gangsters and gambling, rather than just show it to you. It wants to drag you along through it head first. There's all sorts of interesting things happening with the mise-en-scene in this film. If you look at numerous scenes have pools of light reflecting off things like steering wheels or tables or work surfaces. So if you see this film again, look out for that. The way Scorsese uses pop music in this film is the strongest out of all of his career. And Gimme Shelter by the Stones comes in more than once. And there's a couple of other Stones songs on the soundtrack too. Again, a very violent movie, very disturbing in places, and a real epic. It also works as a comedy. It's laugh out loud funny. And one thing I really like about it is the weaving in of multiple different voiceovers. You've got Robert De Niro's voiceover, you've got Joe Pesci's voiceover, and also at one point the voiceover of a minor character played by Frank Vincent, who is one of Pesci's gangster henchmen. Sharon Stone's also in this film, in probably her best acting performance. At number two, Casino. Now, at number one, I've gone for Jackie Brown. Now, yes, this list is Tarantino heavy, but I think it's appropriate given how influential his films were, not just on cinema, but on music and culture more broadly. Now, watch crime thrillers made prior to 1993 and watch them after, and you can see a definite shift in tone and how the films were made and the prevalence of ensemble casts, of quotable dialogue, of intertextuality, etc., etc. Now, you might not like it, but the impact really was immeasurable. Anyway, as many people have said, Jackie Brown is his best film. It's also atypical in that he didn't originate the script. It's based on an Elmore Leonard novel. And a lot of people at the time maybe thought it was a step down from Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, but I think now a lot more people realise that this may well have been his peak. It's such an elegiac movie. It's so warm. Witness the scene between Michael Keaton, Michael Bowen and Pam Grier, where their characters all say hi to each other after they've agreed to work with each other on capturing the villain, Ordell, played by Samuel L. Jackson. It's such a rare moment of relaxation and friendliness in the midst of what's supposed to be an edgy crime thriller. It's very atypical. It's a wonderful piece of confidence, filmmaking confidence and scriptwriting confidence, that you can have these characters just talk and say hi and have a laugh and a joke with each other in a way that looks natural and is not about dialogue or is not about proving a point. And in that regard, there's a slacker sensibility to this movie that's wholly in keeping with 90s cinema more generally. So there we go. My top film of the 1990s, Jackie Brown. So, what have we learned from all this? Well, the 1990s wasn't a great decade for horror. There are surprisingly few horror films made it in here. We've got a few. Scream, Fire Walk With Me, and Seven, if you want to include that as a horror movie, I guess we can. But they're all not typical of horror cinema. And I think maybe this was natural, that the 80s had been such a great decade for the genre of horror, so maybe it was natural for it to recede a little bit into the 1990s. Crime films instead dominate this list, which again you could argue is the result of the impact that Quentin Tarantino had on cinema in the decade. Okay, so that's pretty much it. If you don't like my list, go and get your own. Thanks to Amanda and Chris for their valuable contributions. And thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.